So what factors enabled us to have the ability to listen to the Dharma this morning? So surely keeping ethical conduct in a previous life resulted in our having a human body. And then other actions we did in previous lives of generosity and so forth ripened in us having enough to eat, having an education, having the material wherewithal to have the time and the opportunity to listen to the teachings. And it also depends on prayers that we made in a previous life, to have a precious rebirth, to be able to continue our practice in the future. And then it also depends on choices that we made in this life, choosing to be at the Abbey right now, choosing to come to the teachings. So there's many, many causes and conditions that have to come together, of many different types of causes and conditions. And so somehow they've come together, and we have the opportunity to listen to this precious text. And our ability to listen to it is also due to the kindness of the people who translated from Sanskrit into Tibetan, and then centuries later from Tibetan into English. So much went into this one little precious moment. And what we do in this one precious moment will create some of the causes and conditions for what follows later in this life and also in future lives. So we want to make sure that we listen and pay attention closely, and that we do so with a good motivation, really seeking to improve the state of our mind, improve our actions, physical, verbal, and mental, and to improve them why? Not just for our own welfare, not for reputation, not for praise and approval, but so we can progress on the path to full awakening and develop all the qualities necessary to be of the utmost benefit to other living beings. So cultivate that long-term aspiration and relate it to everything that has been building up from the past, enabling us to have the circumstance that we have right now. So we're in the middle of verse 2, talking about Yamantaka. Verse 1 and 2, I'll read both of them because they come together. When peacocks roam through the jungle of virulent poison, though the gardens of medicinal plants are attractive, the flocks of peacocks will not take delight in them, for peacocks thrive on the essence of virulent poison. Likewise, when the heroes, bodhisattvas, entered the jungle of cyclic existence, though the gardens of happiness and prosperity in liberation may seem beautiful, the heroes will not become attached to them, for heroes thrive in the jungle of suffering. So that's where they practice. And one of the reasons I think this poem is so applicable to our circumstance today is we definitely live in a jungle, yeah, a jungle that considers itself a civilized society. But if you really look at what's going on, it's hardly civilized. And the virulent poisons of the six root afflictions are all over the place, motivating people's actions. And here we are in the middle of it, wanting to create virtue. And if we only look at this world and say, it's so screwed up, it's so terrible, I just can't stand it, I've got to get liberated, then we're not going to be very happy here and now, and we're going to push the world away, push other sentient beings away, and just look for our own liberation. Okay? Bodhisattvas have a very different outlook. They say, yes, it's corrupt, and this is the field of my practice. And so I'm going to really use it to create the causes for the happiness of myself and others, for my own and everybody's awakening. So we're bodhisattva wannabes. So we can't approach the world with discouragement and despair. That's the opposite of the bodhisattva ideal. Okay, we have to approach the craziness that we're living in with vigor of this is, you know, this is the deck of cards I've been dealt by karma, and I'm going to make the best of it. Yeah. And so rather than just slink around and feel, oh, I can't stand it here, these people are too much, you know, and says the government, everything's so corrupt. It's just like, okay, this is where I'm practicing. And I've got to have an attitude of joyous effort. I've got to be very clear on what my ethical values are and live by them. I've got to, you know, be an example to other people of how to create the causes of happiness and avoid the causes of suffering. Yeah, and not just sit here and go, oh, but it's so, this world's so awful, and I don't get what I want, and, you know. Bodhisattva wannabes don't cry like that. Yeah, bodhisattva wannabes, when they have, you know, when they have a sincere aspiration to be a bodhisattva, yeah, they don't get depressed and discouraged from this stuff. They jump in, yeah, because we use the bodhisattvas as our example. And if you admire the bodhisattvas and what they do for the world and the state of their mind, you know, then you really want to follow in their footsteps, and become like them. And so we jump in and do it. Okay. Now, because we're bodhisattva wannabes, we don't have the full bodhicitta, we don't have the wisdom realizing emptiness, we can't do the same work as the bodhisattvas. Yeah, because our minds easily get out of whack. So we have to be very mindful of what's going on in our mind, have a lot of introspective awareness that monitors our mind, and know what we can do given our present ability, and know what we can't do yet with our present ability, so that we practice in a way that is in accord with our present ability, but a little bit more. If we just do in accordance with our present ability, we can become very complacent. Yeah, so we have to nudge ourselves a little bit, not push ourselves, not compete with anybody else, but what we can do, but a little bit more. Okay, and that's very much how the adults who raised us when we were kids helped us to grow up. They helped us to do what we could do, and then they nudged us a little bit more. Yeah, it's like, I don't want to go on a bicycle. I want to stay on my tricycle because I feel more secure with three wheels, and just being on two wheels is scary. Yeah. So they put us on a bicycle, but they hold us, and then we try it. We fall off the bicycle a few times. They put us back on. They don't let us stay in the gutter and cry. And they put us back on, and then we try it again, and eventually we learn to ride a bicycle. Yeah. Whereas if, when we said, look, I want to stay on a tricycle, bicycles scare me, they said, okay, then we would still be, you would grow up to be 30 years old riding a tricycle. Yeah. So the nudging part is important. Yeah. But notice, they put us on a bicycle. They don't put us on a motorcycle. We don't go from a tricycle to a motorcycle. Okay. So the nudging is what we can handle, but a little bit more than we have right now. And then that helps us to develop our confidence. Okay. If we fall off the bicycle and then say, I am never, ever, ever getting back on again, well, again, join the club of 30 years old riding their tricycles. Or, you get back on the bicycle again and you're just a little bit more careful and you go a shorter distance and learn to balance yourself. Okay. Do you remember learning to ride a bicycle? Did everybody here learn to ride one? So the Mahayana path leading to full awakening has five paths. Okay. If you can remember the names of these paths, it's very helpful for when they definitely come up as you study more. So the first path is the path of accumulation. Then the path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, and then the path of no more learning. So lower bodhisattvas who are on the paths of accumulation and preparation have not yet realized emptiness directly, and they have not yet begun to eradicate the defilements. The great bodhisattvas who are spoken of in verses 1 and 2 are the Arya bodhisattvas. So they've realized emptiness directly. So they're on the third and fourth paths of seeing and meditation. On the path of seeing, they have their first direct non-conceptual realization of the ultimate nature of phenomena, the emptiness of inherent existence. They strengthen this realization on the path of meditation. Okay. So on these two paths, they use this wisdom to eradicate the two obscurations, the afflictive obscurations and the cognitive obscurations. Afflictive obscurations consist of ignorance, afflictions such as attachment, anger, arrogance, jealousy, and so forth, and the seeds of those afflictions. Okay, as well as the polluted karma causing rebirth in samsara. Actually, I think the polluted karma is not considered one of the afflictive obscurations. It's considered the true origin, the second truth, but it's not one of the obscurations, so that needs to be corrected. The afflictive obscurations prevent liberation from cyclic existence. Cognitive obscurations are more subtle and difficult to eliminate, consisting of the latencies of ignorance and the dualistic appearance they cause. Cognitive obscurations impede attaining the full awakening of a Buddha. Okay, so when we talk about karma, and this will come for a little bit later in Samsara, Nirvana, and Buddha nature, when we talk about karma, sometimes we say the seeds of karma, the imprints of karma. Those basically are pretty much the same. But when we talk about afflictions, we say the seeds of afflictions and the latencies of afflictions, and those are different. Okay? The seeds of afflictions are cognitive obscuration, and they are what remains on the mind stream. I'm sorry, they're afflictive obscurations. Thank you for making a face and reminding me. That's good you do. So the seeds are afflictive obscurations that lie in the mind stream between two manifest events of an affliction. So all our afflictions are not always manifest. Sometimes they're in the state of a seed. Yeah. The cognitive obscurations consist of the latencies of afflictions. And the latencies are different because you can remove the afflictions and the seeds, but still have the latencies. And they describe the latencies using the example of onions. Okay, so you can take onions, when you cook onions, it stinks up everything, right? So you cook onions, you take the onions out of the pot. That's like getting rid of the afflictions and the seeds. But the smell of the onions is still there. So the smell is like the latencies. So the latencies are not consciousnesses. You know, there's this residual obscuration that is left over. Okay. Okay, and those latencies cause what we call the dualistic appearance. In other words, even all sentient beings, including the high-level bodhisattvas, unless they're in meditative equipoise, directly and non-conceptually perceiving emptiness, unless they're in that state, all sentient beings have the appearance of inherent existence. Yeah. These Arya bodhisattvas know the appearance is false. Some of the lower level bodhisattvas do too, but the appearance is still there. Okay. So that's that dualistic appearance. And it's also, yeah, an appearance of subject and object, and the object appears inherently existent. So due to having directly and non-conceptually realized emptiness, and thus begun the process of uprooting ignorance, Arya Bodhisattvas no longer create polluted karma. Okay? So they may still have afflictive obscurations, yeah, but they're not, actually it should say Arya Bodhisattvas no longer create, polluted karma influenced by ignorance. They create unpolluted karma, which is motivated by bodhicitta and acts as the cause for them to attain full awakening. They may still have polluted karma, on their mind streams, but it can no longer ripen in terms of throwing them into a samsaric rebirth. Okay. Why? Because at the time of death, they don't have the eighth and nine links of the 12 links of dependent origination, the links of craving and clinging. So without those two links, any karma that they may have created to be reborn in samsara can't ripen. Okay. But we still say that those bodhisattvas are born in samsara because by the power of their compassion, then they choose to be born in this realm and to make manifest many bodies in this realm. And they do that out of their compassion, not because they're forced to by their own karma. Okay, so they create unpolluted karma, which is motivated by bodhicitta and acts as the cause for them to attain full awakening. After Arya Bodhisattvas become Buddhas, they no longer create karma at all. Okay, Buddha's actions are called awakening activities. Yeah, they're spontaneous and effortless actions that continuously benefit sentient beings by leading them on the path to awakening. Okay, so when we become Buddhas, then we can really be spontaneous and not worry about what we're doing. As ordinary beings, we say, I want to be spontaneous, which means I want to be impulsive. Impulsive and spontaneous from a Dharma viewpoint are very different. Impulsive is, I have an idea, I want to act it out right away. I don't assess it. I don't evaluate whether this is a good thing to do or not. It just feels like I want to do it and I go ahead. Spontaneous for Buddhists means that you are so familiar with creating virtue and having positive attitudes that you don't even need to think of it. There aren't even any seeds of the afflictions in your mind stream left to manifest and cause, and make manifest the non-virtuous afflictions. So your virtue is just spontaneous because you're so habituated to it and there's no other interfering forces. So that would be nice, don't you think? Yeah, to have that kind of mind that just spontaneously had virtuous thoughts without having to sit there. Okay, I got to generate a motivation and I'm sitting here listening to these teachings to benefit all sentient beings, even that guy that cut me off on the highway who I can't stand. Oh, that's a negative thought. Even the guy who cut me off on the highway, who means well, but is under the influence of ignorance. Oh, he's such a stupid jerk. That's a negative thought. I've got to come back to a virtuous one. Yeah. So the Arya Bodhisattvas don't need to do that. It's just, yeah, it's spontaneous. So we ordinary beings differ from great bodhisattvas because we are seduced by the pleasures of cyclic existence. Our first thoughts in the morning usually center on how can I experience pleasure today? Now, we may not word that exactly as our first thought. Yeah, but it's there. Sometimes our first thought is, what is that noise waking me up? Yeah. Oh, it's the alarm clock. Oh, I better get up. Press the snooze button. Okay. So, you know, from the very get-go, every morning we're looking for pleasure. The image of a cup of coffee, a hot shower, and breakfast get us out of bed. Okay, looking for objects that will give us pleasure motivates us. Most of the things we do during the day are similarly fueled by self-centered thought, seeking out our own pleasure and happiness. So there's nothing wrong with experiencing pleasure, and there's nothing wrong with being happy. We should be happy. That's why the Buddha's trying to help us attain awakening, is so we can be happy. Yeah, that's not the problem. The problem is the attachment, the clinging, the anger when we don't get it. Although we may not verbalize it, our motivation is, if there is happiness and advantage, I'll take it. If there are problems, others can have them. Right? So if I can earn some brownie points by, you know, washing the dishes before lunch, I will do that. But if there's no brownie points to be owned, then I disappear and I ask somebody else, please, to go wash the dishes before lunch. Because washing dishes doesn't give me any pleasure. Why doesn't washing dishes give you pleasure? You know, the things we don't like to do. Why doesn't it give us pleasure? That means we get to eat off of clean dishes. That should give us pleasure. Unless you think eating off of dirty dishes brings you more pleasure. If you think that, then yeah, washing dishes is a pain in the neck. But if you like eating off clean plates and you like having cooked food, then washing the dishes should bring us pleasure because that enables us to eat our lunch off of clean plates and have another lunch the next day that's cooked in clean pots. Yeah? So it should bring us pleasure. And if you want to practice Mahayana thought training, then you think you're cleansing the minds of sentient beings from all of their defilements, and then you're really happy washing the dishes. And when you think that you could be pulling knapweed instead of washing the dishes, then you really want to wash the dishes. Unless you like pulling knapweed better, in which you'll do that unless you can get out of doing that too. So what do we experience pleasure from? We don't like this, we don't like that, we don't like this, we don't like that. You know, if you count up how many things in your day you don't like. I don't like the alarm clock. I don't like having to make my bed. I don't like brushing my teeth. Oh, you'd rather go around with unbrushed teeth. Good luck. You know, I don't like this. I don't like that. Yeah. The mind that says, I don't like, is the mind that makes us unhappy. The situation doesn't have to make us unhappy. It's the mind that complains. It's the picky mind, yeah, that makes us unhappy. Yeah. I don't like this. It's clouded today. I don't like the clouds. Oh, it's sunny. Oh, it's going to be too hot and I have to go work outside. I don't like that either. What do you like? You don't like the clouds. You don't like the sun. Yeah. What do we like? We like to complain. Yeah. But does complaining make us happy? Are you happy when you complain? Yeah? Complaining is not, you know, we do it a lot, but it doesn't make us happy. It's not like, you know, oh, I complained today, and now I feel so good. I think I'll complain some more the rest of the day, because then I'll feel even better. Okay. So completely caught up with the eight worldly concerns, we see cyclic existence as a garden of happiness and delight in playing in it. And seeing it as a garden of happiness, and we delight in playing in it. In the process, we act in harmful ways, creating the karmic seeds that bind us to more cyclic existence. Again and again, we take a body that gets old, sick, and dies with a mind that is constantly dissatisfied. Arya bodhisattvas see through the glittering appearance of cyclic existence as a garden of happiness. Seeing its deceptive quality, they know it is actually a hellhole. Or to quote our former president, a sh-hole. Can't say the whole word, otherwise people will beat me out. Okay, instead of running after the glitter of sense pleasure, prestige, or romance, yeah, the Arya Bodhisattvas seek a higher type of happiness and a deeper purpose in life. Having realized the three principal aspects of the path, renunciation of dukkha and its causes, the altruistic intention of bodhicitta that seeks full awakening for the benefit of all beings, and third, the correct view of reality, the Arya Bodhisattvas are able to manifest in cyclic existence, but not be beguiled by it. They have the ability to transform or to take afflictions into the path to awakening. Okay. In the Sutrayana, the path described in the discourses or sutras spoken by the Buddha, bodhisattvas do not actually take the afflictions as the path, but use them. There it should say transform the afflictions into the path, but they use them to do things that benefit others. So, for example, they may have children who grow up to be bodhisattvas and spread the Dharma. Yeah. On the Tantrayana, the path taught by the Buddha in the Tantras, bodhisattvas actually take the energy of attachment and take it into the path. Okay, this is a much deeper level of practice. Okay, the third verse. Those who avidly pursue happiness and prosperity are brought to suffering due to their cowardice. Cowardness? Cowardice is a noun, it's not an adjective. Okay. The bodhisattvas who willingly embrace suffering always remain happy due to their heroism. you want to be happy? Be a heroic bodhisattva. Motivated by clinging attachment and greed, we ordinary beings avidly pursue happiness and prosperity. Trying to find security, we want others to meet our needs. Isn't it? We have all sorts of emotional needs, and we expect other people to meet our emotional needs. We never think of learning how to meet our own emotional needs, or even how to lessen those needs. But our mind is thoroughly directed towards getting other people to meet those needs. And other people can't. Yeah, they may love us up, down, and across, but it's hard to meet another person's emotional needs when that other person is never satisfied. And when you cannot keep track of what they need from one moment to the next moment. One moment they want you to be cheerful, the next moment they want you to be serious. Yeah, other sentient beings are completely unpredictable. Trying to meet their emotional needs, we never get it right. And other people who try and meet our emotional needs, because our minds are so unpredictable and we're so moody, they can never succeed in doing it. And even if they try to, we never quite believe them. Okay? Even somebody says, I love you and you're the best and da 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 da, we still lack self-confidence. Yeah? The whole world can be praising us, but we still don't have confidence in ourselves. Okay? Because we're going about it the wrong way. We're thinking that external things can fulfill the inner ones. Yeah. Rather than learning how to transform our mind to either fulfill our own needs or to diminish those needs. Do we really need somebody saying, I love you 20 times a day in order to feel cared for? You know, can they go down to 15 times a day and we'll be okay? Or maybe 5 times a day? Or maybe they don't even need to say it because we have confidence in ourselves and because we are giving love to others. So we're not so focused on, am I getting the love I want? So what were we here? Okay, in cyclic existence, we experience 3 types of unsatisfactory circumstances, or dukkha. The dukkha of pain, physical and mental pain that no one likes, and that is easy to renounce. Even animals don't like it. However, the dukkha of change, what we ordinary beings usually call happiness, is difficult for us to give up because we think it is real happiness. When we get what we want, a promotion, a new home, a romantic relationship, a reward, we believe that to be genuine happiness. However, if it were real happiness, it wouldn't disappear. And the object or person that brings us joy one day would not be problematic the next. When you fall in love, somebody is 100% wonderful. Yeah. Do they remain 100% wonderful? In your eyes, are they always wonderful? No. Okay. They fall in love with us. Are we always wonderful and pleasant to be around? No. But we expect them to endure our bad moods because they love us. But we do not like their bad moods, and we refuse to endure them. Difficult in samsara, isn't it? We really try so hard, and then we think we've got it. You finally talk your mother into doing what you think she should do to be safe and well in her old age. And she finally agrees to it. And then what? She calls you and she says, I can't stand living in this assisted living place. I want to go home. But mom, dad, it's not so safe for you there. Yeah, if you fall down, you stay down. Nobody's going to pick you up. And, you know, you don't have carpeting in the whole room, so you're going to fall on the, you know, on the hard floor. It's too dangerous for you. I'm fine. I'm the adult. I'm the parent. Remember, stop telling me what to do. Mom, dad, you know, it's really time to give up the car keys. You know, let us take you places. We want to be your chauffeur. You've driven us around years and years, taking us to soccer practice and music lessons. Let us drive you around for a while. Give me the car keys. Oh, God. Yeah, you tried that with a parent? Good luck. Yeah. My mom was smart, you know. She knew her eyesight was going. She gave the car keys up. But my dad had them. Dad, no way was going to give up those car keys. Yeah. And even when they were hidden, he would find them and go out for a cruise on his own. Yeah. So finally you get somebody to do what you want them to do. And then they rebel. They don't do it, you know. Yeah. Or worse yet, they crash the car. Yeah. What happens, you know, that you fear the most? Okay. However, if it were real happiness, it wouldn't disappear. And the object or person that brings us joy one day would not be problematic the next. The dukkha of pervasive conditioning, having a body and mind under the control of ignorance, afflictions, and polluted karma, is even more difficult to relinquish because we do not think of it as undesirable. We do not think that having this kind of body is undesirable. It's the only kind of body we've ever known in this life, and we think it's great, and it brings us some happiness sometimes, and we don't see any alternative. So one, you know, nobody wants different aggregates. We don't want to give up our body. We don't want to give up our afflictions. Okay, we think all of this is just what life is. Yeah. And so we continue on in samsara. Because as they say, be careful of what you want, you might get it. And we got it. So quite the opposite. We cling to our body as the basis of our identity and the source of much of our pleasure. Yeah, bodhisattvas have a body. They take care of it, like you take care of any possession that can be useful. But they aren't attached to it. Yeah, they don't worry about how it looks. They don't worry about, you know, the endless things that we worry about with our body. Oh, my little toe hurts. That's terrible. It's going to spread through my whole body. My whole foot's going to hurt. Then I can't walk. Then it's going to creep up my leg. And then I'm not going to be able to walk at all. And it all started with my little toe. Oh, dear. Actually, if you've ever had one of your toes with a boil on it, it really hurts, you know. You feel like death is coming soon. But it's not. Yeah. Okay, the cowardice that brings us suffering refers to our clinging attachment. Okay, so that line in the verse was, those who avidly pursue happiness and prosperity are brought to suffering due to their cowardice. Okay, so that cowardice brings us suffering. The cowardice that brings us suffering refers to our clinging attachment, a mental factor that seeks happiness through obtaining external possessions, relationships, praise, status, and so on. This craving prevents us from facing the unsatisfactory nature of our existence and the unsatisfactory nature and then the disadvantages of greed and attachment. Instead, we are attracted to the pleasures of cyclic existence. We create more karma by pursuing them, and as a result, we are repeatedly reborn. We are cowardly in the sense that we are afraid to see attachment for what it is. Yeah. We let attachment deceive us, and we're afraid to call it out. We fear that if we don't follow our attachment, we won't have any happiness at all. Yeah. If I don't get my chocolate chip cookies, my life is doomed. Okay, there will be no happiness. Yeah. Due to our cowardice in facing the realities of the situation, we are brought to suffering. Yeah. A person we care about dies, we reject that. They cannot die. They do not have my permission to die. Dying is not in our plans. There's something wrong with dying. Yeah. I reject that they've died. I will not accept it. Yeah. And that's what people often go through when they're grieving the loss of a dear one. Whereas if there's somebody who's thought a lot beforehand about their dear ones dying, and they have that in their mind, and they, you know what they don't want to leave anything left unsaid that needs to be said, so they're always honest and forthright, and they apologize, and they forgive, and they keep their relationships very clean and healthy. Then when somebody dies because they've thought about it, they know it's happening, they don't reject the reality of it. Yeah. Then they are concerned for the person who died. When we grieve, we are usually concerned with our loss. Yeah, we aren't there for the person who's dying. But when we've thought about their death and we've accepted it before they die, then we can actually be present for them when they are dying and when they need help. Okay, I saw that once when a friend who was also a student was dying, and so his wife was in the room, his best friend and his two kids and me, and the four others were, they were so attached to him that it was so difficult, you know, to watch him die, and they were really overwhelmed by their own grief. And I was the one who was giving him directions about what to think and what to imagine as he was dying. They couldn't be there for him and give him Dharma advice because their own grief, their own attachment was too powerful. Yeah. So that's not a criticism of them. This is the way ordinary people are, you know? But if we can see the disadvantages of attachment, then we can start working on our attachment now instead of waiting. Yeah. So great bodhisattvas are the opposite. They are heroic in that they stand up to their craving and refrain from chasing after samsaric happiness. In addition, they do not fear the dukkha of cyclic existence in the same way we ordinary beings do. We fear the first kind of dukkha, but happily embrace the second and the third. While bodhisattvas want to be free of all three, but if they are faced with experiencing pain in order to benefit others, they will happily do that, whereas we run away. Bodhisattvas fear cyclic existence. Okay, so their fear of cyclic existence is not the panicky, anxious fear that plagues ordinary beings who seek to avoid discomfort. Theirs is a wise awareness of danger that propels them to practice the path and liberate themselves from cyclic existence. Such a fear of cyclic existence, or an awareness of the danger of cyclic existence, is useful on the path as it instigates us to study and practice the Dharma. Unlike common beings, bodhisattvas willingly undergo suffering for a higher purpose. With fortitude and compassion for all sentient beings, they learn the Dharma and practice the path, whatever physical or mental difficulties they may encounter. Not fearing unpleasant tasks, they willingly go through the hardship for the benefit of others, and as a result, their minds are always joyful. Yeah, so if you're sincerely engaged in practice, your external circumstances may not be, like the Ritz Hotel, but you don't care about that, you know. You're more interested in doing your practice and transforming your mind. And, you deal with the circumstances and you don't sit there and visualize being in the Ritz Hotel. Or what else is there? The Four Seasons Hotel. That one became famous. The Hilton. I find it quite interesting how people like staying in expensive hotels. It's not something I enjoy. It feels very unnatural. Yeah, it feels very fake. When I travel, I much prefer to stay in somebody's home than in a hotel. We can gradually train our mind to look at the world the way bodhisattvas do. We do not have fixed personalities, and our habitual emotions and responses are not cast in stone. Let's say somebody makes a reasonable request that we do a task that we dislike doing, like vacuuming the stairs. I'm fine vacuuming the floor. Vacuuming the stairs and having to carry the vacuum cleaner up and down and try and vacuum at the same time. I do not like doing that. Okay. So let's say somebody makes a reasonable request that we do a task that we dislike doing, and our mind silently screams, I don't want to do this. Okay. If that happens, not if it happens, when it happens, mentally step back from the situation and reflect, how would a bodhisattva look at this situation? Okay. What would this situation look like if I had compassion for everyone concerned? Then I'd love to vacuum those stairs because everybody would enjoy clean stairs. But somebody else can also vacuum it too. Okay, what options would I have if I weren't confined to my complaining mind? What would happen if I didn't sit there and go, I don't want to do this task. I can't stand it. Na, 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 na. It's unfair. I had to do it last week. So-and-so does the rota. She never puts herself doing this. She gets the easy tasks. Yeah, like washing the windows. I like washing the windows. I don't like vacuuming the stairs. You know, this is unfair. The whole world is unfair. Okay. So what would happen if I weren't confined to my complaining mind? What happened if I just stopped complaining? You know, what a practice of renunciation that is. Especially when complaining is one of our favorite things to do. Yeah. So what would happen if I didn't complain? Here we imagine looking at the situation with a kinder attitude and from a broader perspective. Doing this, we see that it's possible to view it in an entirely different way because there's nothing unpleasant inherent in the situation. You know, okay, there's some kitty litter on the stairs. And there's some dirt, and some of it I put there. And there's some fur, and there's the stains when she threw up. The cat threw up, not me. And there, you know, there's some leaves, and, you know, there's a whole clutter of vegetation from the abbey. You know, the kind of vegetation people collect and put in a museum. Here, look at an example of the kind of rocks they have at the Abbey. We have some pretty rocks out there, actually. Okay, but what would happen if I didn't complain? If I just said, you know, okay, it's dirty, I clean it, finished. What would happen if I got over this whole thing of it's unfair and I don't want to? And vacuuming the stairs is beneath my pay grade. I can't do that. Why? Because I'm me. And I'm special and other people have to vacuum the stairs. So I'm happy there's people in this world who like to vacuum the stairs. Yeah, they can do it all they want. In fact, I rejoice when they're happy vacuuming. Okay. But what would happen if I gave up that whole mental state that makes me so miserable? Okay. So this is a small example. Think of something else when your attachment is stronger and so your dislike is stronger. And what would happen if you gave up your trip? I was reading that, Bill and Melinda Gates' kids went to a private school. And usually it's the mothers who drive their kids to school. Well, one day, Bill Gates drove his kids to school, and all the other parents saw it. And after that, all the mothers were saying to their husbands, Bill Gates drove their kids to school. You can do it too. But actually, I think driving your kids to school would be a really fun time. The couple that's coming today, yeah, the father takes their kids to school. And he talks to them during the car rides about what they see, and they imagine situations, and he explains kindness to them, and it's quite amazing, and he quite enjoys it, and so do the kids. Yeah. So why are we so resistant to certain activities? Yeah. Why do we dislike them? And especially, what are the activities where we think we are too good to do that? We're doing that is below my social status. Yeah. Walking in the park and you see trash, that is other people's trash. I will not pick it up. I would much rather walk in a park littered with garbage then pick up the garbage and walk in a park that is not littered. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah. But how our pride, our sense of caste, our sense of social position, yeah, interfere with us doing certain things. So doing this, we see that it's possible to view a situation in an entirely different way because there's nothing unpleasant inherent in the situation. What is so painful about washing the dishes? What is so painful about helping our friends clean their yard? Or what is so painful about talking with our ex about how to help the children we both love? Then we reflect, wouldn't it be nice to do the chores so my aging parents can relax? Yeah, what happened if we thought that? Imagine how they would feel and reflect how good you would feel knowing that you contributed to their well-being. We discover that by doing a small action with genuine compassion, a genuine good heart, our minds become joyful. Indeed, researchers have found that people experience a greater sense of well-being from helping others than they do from just seeking their own benefit. Interesting, isn't it, that researchers find that? I think if I were the subject, they would not have found that. Shall we do another verse? Okay, verse 4. Here now, desire is like the jungle of virulent poison. The peacock-like heroes alone can digest this. But for the crow-like cowards, it spells death. For how can the self-centered digest such poison? When you extend this analogy to other afflictions, each similarly assails liberation's life force like poison to a crow. Okay, so the bodhisattvas thrive on the poison, they thrive on the difficulties of samsara. They're able to take the afflictions into the path and use them in a different way. But for the crows are like cowards, and for them, when they take poison, they die. Yeah. And so for us who are like, who are not bodhisattvas, who are cowards, yeah, then if we try and take the afflictions into the path, we botch it up and our spiritual practice goes south, you know, and it assails liberations like life force. So we go in the opposite direction. Okay. And you see people who are not ready to do that practice of taking afflictions in the path. And what, you know, very often there's a lot of problems that follow. So here in the verse refers to bodhisattvas who have developed confidence and compassion on the initial levels of the path. Now indicates they have progressed so that their compassion aiming to benefit others is strong and stable, and they have a correct view of reality. Okay, so these are the bodhisattvas we're talking about now. This gives them the special ability to use clinging desire to accomplish the path without being polluted by it. Just as the peacocks can digest poisonous plants and it makes their feathers brighter and beautiful, Arya bodhisattvas can work with afflictions, thereby increasing the power of their realizations. Okay, crows cannot do that. Yeah, people who are not qualified, who don't have that level of the path, can't do that. However, if crows try to eat poisonous plants, they couldn't stomach them and would surely die. Similarly, ordinary self-centered beings cannot do the actions of great bodhisattvas. If we tried to take desire on the path, our desire would overwhelm us, causing us to get involved in many destructive actions. This would spell the death of the opportunity to attain liberation. Just as crows need to avoid poisonous plants, we need to stay away from our afflictions. Okay? Not to encourage our afflictions, not to think that we are high-level practitioners and can transform them. I was once at a conference, and it was a really crazy kind of conference of Buddhist practitioners. And there was one woman there who was frustrated with the craziness of the conference. And she got up, and there were some, because we were all sitting in the meditation hall, and there were zafus and zabutons. And she took the zabutons, started throwing them, you know. I mean, they were heavy, and she was small. Throw one here, throw one there, and throw one here. And everybody stops and looks at her, you know, what's going on? You know, what are you doing? And she said, I'm using crazy wisdom to shake up, you know, shake you people up. It was crazy. I don't know about the wisdom part of it. Okay. Yeah. Because it didn't get the point across to the people that she wanted to influence. Okay. When we hear that tantric practice can transform or can take afflictions into the path, our minds may invent a variety of excuses about how we could use desire on the path. We rationalize going against the five lay precepts of abandoning, killing, stealing, unwise or unkind sexual behavior, lying, and intoxicants. Holding skewed views that and an inflated opinion of our present abilities, we imagine being further along the path than we actually are. This is a recipe for spiritual disaster that unfortunately many people fall prey to. Yes, that's true. Dharma Rakshita's disciple Atisha described the path to full awakening as having three tiers. A clear understanding of the schema enables us to accurately assess our present capabilities and what we at present need to emphasize in our practice, so we may practice different levels of the path, but we need to emphasize certain levels. Okay? People of initial capacity cultivate the aspiration for a fortunate rebirth and practice abandoning the 10 destructive actions in order to do so. They may also choose to live according to the 5 precepts for lay practitioners or the various sets of monastic precepts. That's initial level practitioners. People of intermediate capacity cultivate renunciation of cyclic existence and the aspiration to attain liberation. They continue to practice ethical conduct as above, and in addition, cultivate concentration and wisdom. People of advanced capacity, that's the third level, are motivated by bodhicitta, the aspiration for full awakening in order to benefit all sentient beings most effectively. To accomplish this, they assume the bodhisattva precepts, and when they are well trained in those, they may receive tantric empowerment and take on the tantric commitments and ethical code. We don't start out as beings of advanced capacity. Even though we may admire bodhicitta and be attracted to the bodhisattva path, we still have to build up to them by practicing the paths in common with the initial and intermediate capacity beings. Okay, in order to take calculus at college, you have to take arithmetic in first grade. There's no way around it. And you have to take algebra in your freshman year in high school and geometry in your second year. You know, and so on. You don't start out taking calculus, even though you admire it and think it's wonderful and aspire to do it. Until we are well trained in all three aspirations and their corresponding practices, it's important to be vigilant regarding our interactions with objects of attachment. This is not because those objects or people are bad, but because we are not yet skilled in restraining our attachment and maintaining a balanced state of mind when we're around them. Okay, so it's not because other people or objects are bad. We have to admit our weakness and be honest with ourselves. Bodhisattva practitioners on the higher levels of the path can enjoy objects of attachment because they know the pleasure is deceptive. It is impermanent and lacks inherent existence. Due to their wisdom, they do not become entangled in attachment. Instead, well-trained tantric practitioners are able to generate the blissful wisdom that realizes emptiness by enjoying those pleasures. However, if those of us whose minds are overwhelmed with attachment surround ourselves with objects of attachment, we get sucked in by them and create more causes of suffering by trying to procure them and then to protect our objects of attachment. Okay. So those of us who take monastic precepts live simply. We accept that we need to stay alive and train our minds not to chase after more and better. For example, at Srivasti Abbey, the monastery where I live, we eat only food that is offered to us, although we prepare and cook the food that others give us. This helps us deal with attachment to food. If our minds crave cookies and no one offers them, we confront our attachment, asking ourselves, will I be forever happy if I have cookies? Yes, yes, yes. No, no, no is the right answer. No, I won't be. Will cookies stop my mental restlessness? Yes, yes. No, they won't. Clearly, the answer is no. So we let go of the attachment and cultivate contentment. Living in this way also helps us to develop a sense of gratitude for the kindness of the people who support us, instead of thinking, you know, why aren't they bringing the kind of food I like? Yeah, it's like, wow, they're bringing food, and they go to work and work, you know, not 8 hours a day, and out of the goodness of their hearts, they make offerings to our monastery, and we get to eat. You know, we have that kind of gratitude in the minds. Meditating on impermanence is important to help us understand what is actually important in life and to set our priorities accordingly. In light of our mortality and the possibility of having an unfortunate rebirth, having cookies or whatever we are craving is not important. I mean, really. Yeah. It's one day, next week, we won't remember that we lacked cookies today. A year from now, we won't even think about it. It is not important, okay? And those things won't bring us the lasting joy and fulfillment we seek, even if we get them, okay? Whereas taming our mind and relinquishing craving and attachment will. Meditating on the defects of cyclic existence enables us to see its unsatisfactory nature, and this reduces our interest in its transient pleasures, thus making our minds more peaceful and satisfied. Eventually, by realizing emptiness, we will cut the root of our craving and attachment completely. Wow, that'd be nice. In short, genuine joy and fulfillment come from transforming our hearts and minds. This is something that each of us can do. Okay, so we will stop here for this year. And next year, start with verse 5. So please mark that down. Page 32, verse 5. Okay, we don't really have time for questions, but if you have one or two.
I wonder a little bit if the author was referring to coward-like, more to those who have Dharma knowledge, but are not courageous enough to apply it. Because I think most of us who grew up not with Dharma, have rather ignorance and therefore are not really knowing how to.
I think he's especially teaching, you know, to the people who've heard Dharma but don't apply it. But he's also including the other people as well. Yeah. Because sometimes, I mean, give worldly people some credit. Yeah. I mean, sometimes they can realize that their attachment is bringing them pain. And that their anger is making them very unhappy. I mean, they can see that from their experience. Okay.